today's interview episode as we begin part 6 of the miniseries, episode 67, and I am pleased to bring you a conversation that I had with Bruce McKenna, who is the writer of part 6. He also worked on some of the other parts in the miniseries, and he was also the producer and lead writer of the miniseries The Pacific, which came out 9 years after Band of Brothers. So enjoy. So today's interview, I'm going to be talking with Bruce McKenna, who is one of the writers of Band of Brothers. He's also one of the writers of The Pacific and also one of the producers of The Pacific. But, you know, obviously, we're going to talk mostly about Band of Brothers today. So, Bruce, thank you very much for joining me and being willing to tell your story.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's an honor. So, yeah, my story.
Yeah, exactly. So, obviously, we'll start from the beginning. How did you get involved in this little project called Band of Brothers?
I begged. I begged and begged and begged. It was very early in my career. I'd sold a couple things. Ironically, both were World War II related. One was a script about Navajo code talkers, and the other was a project about the radar program in England during the Battle of Britain. And but I heard about this from my manager. He said, "Oh, somebody from HBO told me they might be looking for writers for this spinoff of Saving Private Ryan," was how it was
right,
basically.
Obviously.
And I'm like, I'm in, because I'd been a huge World War II buff ever since I was a little kid. Not about the weapons or the tanks or the battles or the generals, but about what the men went through. And so it was sort of right up my alley, and I quickly read the book, immediately got a general meeting with the executive at HBO, you know, blathered on probably 900 words a minute. So they said, "Oh, get out of my office." And they sent me over to Playtone, and I begged them and talked to them. And then they brought me back. Eventually they gave me the series Bible, the infamous mysterious series Bible, which is, you know, huge. It's like 190 pages long. And I went back into Playtone probably 4 times to pitch 4 or 5 different episodes. You know, I would do the episode 3 like this, and I would do the episode, and they finally agreed to hire me. And I guess they had read my code talker script, and, you know, it was good enough that they knew I could write. And so they hired me to write episode 6, the first of the Bastogne episodes.
Right. Okay.
And I found out later that I was the last writer hired, and probably I was given the episode nobody else wanted to do.
So, episode 6 is the one that follows Doc Rowe, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, when I was hired to work on it, it was the episode where nothing major happens. It's not the crossroads. It's not Carentan. It's not D-Day. It's not the training. It's not the last patrol. It's not where everybody dies. You know, the infamous Foy sequence at Bastogne. It's not finding the camps. Each one of these episodes has a major event in them that are easy to hang the episode around. And the Bastogne episode, on the surface of it, they were just cold and suffered.
Mm-hmm.
A couple guys got wounded, you know, one replacement died. So the challenge was to figure out how to create and craft a meaningful episode that kept the viewers engaged so that they continue to watch episode 7, you know? So, very early in the process, I hit upon, I thought was a good idea to follow Doc Rowe, the medic. Little known, you know, inside baseball about Band, I was told, "You can't do that. You know, that's not going to work. He's not one of our main guys, but it's got to be a Lipton or Winters," or, you know, and I'm like, "Well, Winters is not on the front line anymore. He's up at Battalion HQ. You know, it's just, they're all in their separate foxholes. What are we going to do?" And the only person that I figured out took us all around the front were the medics, Ralph Spina and Doc Rowe.
Mm-hmm.
So then I realized it was a great, we could kill a bunch of birds with one stone, because Doc checked in on everybody. I learned very quickly how important he was to the men for morale, not just when they were wounded. And so I sort of had this half-baked idea, okay, maybe I'll just do Doc Rowe and we'll figure out, you know, where he is. And so I asked and was given permission to fly to Denver to go to the 1999 reunion of Easy Company at some airport hotel in Denver. And I spent 4 days with Easy Company, drinking with them, getting to know them, taping them. I have, you know, a lot of taped interviews with a lot of guys.
Wow.
And, you know, and just talk to them about what Eugene Rowe was like. And it became obvious to me that I'd hit upon a really interesting angle into combat and what it's like to be in combat that we didn't do on the show, and nobody's done. Nobody's ever really followed a medic and what it means to be a medic in combat. So, you know, I came back with a wealth of material, not just on Doc Rowe, but on everybody in the company. And then, you know, talked to Dick Winters about it and what, tell me about him, talked to Ralph Spina a lot, because Ralph was alive. He was the only medic still alive in Easy Company. And he told me how important Doc was to him, because he was a replacement who came in Holland. And so Doc taught him how to be a medic, you know, that kind of thing. And then I went and found every piece of literature that there is on medics in World War II, whether it was the Pacific or in Europe. And there's not very many, to be honest.
Right.
So, you know, it began to take shape at that point. And then, of course, I discovered the two nurses, the Belgian nurse and Renee Lemaire.
Mm-hmm.
And then the episode got deeper and deeper and deeper. And I realized I had something.
How did you discover the nurses? Just based on the stories from Ralph or some of the other guys? Or because, again, this was something directly with Doc Rowe. So if
yes,
you couldn't speak with Doc,
somebody
Doc Rowe,
told me. Somebody, it wasn't Doc. I mean, it wasn't Doc's grandson. It might have been Ralph. It might have been. I talked to a battalion surgeon who knew Doc Rowe. I'd met him during Bastogne, you know, and he was the 506th surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
Told me some interesting things. He was in Bastogne. It might have been him. And then you can go online and learn a little bit about Renee, you know,
right,
on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Not much. There's not much on her. But I knew she had been married. I knew she was 18. And I also know that she was not really the trained nurse. It was the Belgian girl who was the trained nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, she spoke French, spoke no English. And the men didn't really know her very well. All of the guys that I talked to that were alive, that were in Bastogne, that were in the town, you know, had medical issues or went back for treatment or were surgeons, remember her. Every single one.
Wow.
Because she was beautiful. And they remember her. They called her the angel of Bastogne because she would touch them. She would bring them chocolate. She would, you know, make them feel better. The Belgian nurse was busy stitching them up. And Renee was busy attending to their souls and their hearts. And so, you know, from there, I was like, okay, well, is it, the next thing you have to do is, well, is it possible that Doc met her? And the answer is yes. I flipped the medical stations. The Easy Company one, the battalion medical aid station was in the city hall at the other end of town. And the other one, you know, for the 50, whatever it was in the church.
Mm-hmm.
I flipped it obviously for thematic reasons because the
right,
episode's stocked full of religious imagery.
Yes.
It's all about healing and touch and, you know, so, you know, and then I just researched as much as possible into what that would have looked like and what it meant to be in that medical aid station. Knowing Doc was from Louisiana, I called up his grandson and got to know him very well.
Chris, right?
And yeah, and Longway, yeah. And he was fantastic. Like, wow, he was fantastic because Chris remembered him, you know, told me about the family and we talked about the idea of a traiteuse in the family. He says, I don't know if there was or not, but it's possible. You know, so we, you know, we went with that because traiteuse, it's all about touch, you know, healing through touch. And, you know, and the whole episode is about touch. It's about it's about love and touch and the men touching each other, Eugene touching all the guys, being
right,
touched by them. And, you know, and also, you know, it's about the weight of death on that guy. And, you know, he can't expiate it. There's nowhere for him to go with his
sure,
emotions. And so, you know, just started to take shape and, you know, talked to Dick Winters about it and he liked the idea. And we, the writers, we spent a lot of time talking to Dick, all of the guys. I mean, you know, before the actors were ever involved, we were the ones that bonded with the men and picked them clean as much as we could. And then the actors, you know, took over and got even deeper into these guys and who they were. But so that's how I got involved. And you know, it was, I mean, it's the best piece of writing I've ever done. So I'm very proud of the episode and what I was able to do to show what it's like to be in combat for somebody who can't shoot back, you know. So,
very true. No, I mean, see, what's always amazed me about Band of Brothers is, I've read the book. And so the book will tell a little story in one sentence about some event. I mean, even the best examples come from, you know, the first part of the miniseries, you know, when they're in training. You know, you have the whole thing just with the with the spaghetti incident, for instance, right? So just it's literally one or two sentences in the whole book. And, you know, you have a writer who's writing it and takes that and expands on it and gives us, you know, a 3-minute segment that deals with that.
Yeah.
You know? So well, to me, that's just amazing to be able to do that. Because the book Band of Brothers, as great as it is, it's not a linear story. You know, it's not told in the regular way that when you're reading a novel, that type of thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, it's a different kind of narrative. And look, I mean, I can't speak for the other writers, but when I got hired, I never looked at the book again. I mean, I just put it aside and I did my own interviews. And, you know, so I interviewed 26 of those guys. I have interviews with all of them.
Wow.
And Stephen Ambrose focused on Winters and Nixon and Harry Welsh and Lipton. He focused on the officers and the top sergeants, Garnier. And, you know, he didn't focus as much on some of the line guys or privates and corporals. And then, you know, just because Winters was such a compelling character, which we understood, but we focused on, I mean, I talked to Winters as much as anybody else, and he was enormously helpful. But, you know, I spent hours talking to Earl McLung and Shifty Powers. And, you know, so that spaghetti story is the result of probably Eric Jenderson talking to a couple of the guys about the spaghetti. And they go, oh, yeah, the fucking spaghetti story. And they ripped on it. You know, and then we obviously take liberties and flesh things out, and
yeah, of course.
You know,
of
but
course.
You know, I mean, look, I have enough material to do the series all over again from the point of view of a bunch of other guys that would be totally different and also the same. You know,
well, yeah, of course.
So,
of course.
You know, like I loved Earl McLung. He was my favorite guy to talk to, one of the most honest men about what it's like to be in combat. And we have him in the show a little bit, but he was an extraordinary character. And, you know, I wish we had done him a little better in the show than we did. He was, cause he often acted as the scout. You know, he's on point for their patrols, which means he's ahead of them. And the object is to make contact.
Right.
But what really happens is the Germans let the point through. So he's constantly getting cut off and he's behind German lines throughout the war. And he was by far the best sort of eyes and ears for the company. He could smell the Germans. He could smell their leather.
Wow.
And he had a sort of a supernatural ability to, and the men depended on that. And I thought that was fantastic. You know, and he also summed up warfare in one sort of pithy paragraph for young men. He said on D-Day, so you have to understand, on D-Day, I was 17. My parents signed the papers so I could get in it early. He was from, you know, Eastern Washington State, from one of the tribes up there. I forget which one. Joined up. I was 17 years old. You have to understand, I was told, I was actually ordered to break as many of the Ten Commandments as I could. Kill, steal, you know, curse. And when you tell a 17-year-old you can do that, it is exhilarating.
Exactly.
So when I landed, I killed with abandon. I mean, it was just like, I get to kill people. He said, by the end of the first day, I realized the Germans were shooting back. So I got scared and I began to kill even more proficiently and coldly because I was really scared. At first, I wasn't scared. It's like a video game.
Right.
And then I began to kill with a calculation and a cruelty and a coldness because I was so scared. By the end of the third day, I was so disgusted with myself that until the end of the war, I never shot another man unless I was directly threatened.
Wow.
So, the moral evolution of what it's like, was really interesting to me.
Yeah, for sure.
And
And to carry that
I
for
really,
60, 70 years after that is also
yeah.
something, very
So,
big.
just
Wow.
learning about the guys in that way, learning about the little stuff about, and some of the stuff we couldn't put in the show because it was people were still alive, and we had to be careful. But
Right.
who shot spears in Holland and that kind of stuff. So but yeah, it was just a labor of love. I mean, I just spent as much time with them calling them. And all the writers, of course, interacted quite well together. We I suppose arrogantly called ourselves the Band of Writers. And every day we would, and once I knew, for instance, in episode six I was going to focus on Gene Roe, then I would call up the other guys and say, "Look, can you set me up in episode three? Can you put Eugene in that scene that you wrote it with Winters and Nixon, where Winters gets shrapnel in his foot, or can you do that? Yes, so that we can see Roe because he wasn't in the show before that. He wasn't really in the Bible. So, and then they would say, "Well, can you set up, so and so getting, whatever?" Obviously, I knew I had to set up Lipton breaking in seven. I'm not Lipton.
Buck Compton.
Buck Compton breaking in episode seven. So I wrote that scene of him out on the OP talking about the cheerleaders and and he that's something he told me that he'd lost his girlfriend. She wrote him a Dear John letter. That's a true story.
Wow.
But we all helped each other, flush out and make sure we covered. So whatever connective tissue there is in the show was actually created by the writers. We were told actually not to talk to each other, to write 10 separate 1-hour movies.
Really? That's actually interesting. If you want there to be some sort of continuity, so to tell everyone not to be in touch. Interesting.
And we disobeyed that order immediately. And thank God. So.
I mean, again, the miniseries is amazing, and in my opinion, it's one of the best, if not the best, miniseries ever made because of the way that the story is told. You really can feel the characters.
They're really well drawn,
And I'm
and
not just saying that
that's
because I'm
just
talking to you.
no. I look at it. I'm very proud of it, but to the extent that it's first rate, it's two things. It's a lot of things, but from the very top, Hanks and Spielberg's commitment to getting this right, to HBO's commitment to spending a lot of money to do it when World War II was not very popular in Hollywood, to the writers, really digging in, and all of us were passionate about the show. I mean, just to the we're all a terrible pain in the ass in production's hide because we were just constantly pushing people to get it right, get it right, get it right. And then, of course, the actors who bonded with the real men, who just did an incredible job of portraying these guys and learning even more about them, because the men eventually opened up more to the actors, and they would come and say, "Hey, look, I just learned this from Buck. Can you put that in the episode?" Of course, we just, whatever the show was the boss, and so it was a wonderful experience. It really was.
Well, I mean, I saw on IMDb that you're actually credited on three episodes, not just on
I
four.
am. I was hired to, after I turned in episode six, I was hired to rewrite episode, I think it was eight after that, which was The
The
Last
Last Patrol.
Patrol. And they had a draft, and they and them so and I, look, I got a reputation as of being that pain in the ass that knows more about the men than anybody else because I had all those interviews with them and spent the most time with them. And so I got the gig to rewrite the episode, which I did, and then I got the they asked me to rewrite episode four, which was
The replacement.
the first Holland, Replacements. Or as we like to call it, bull in a barn,
That's right.
bull getting caught in the barn.
That's right.
And so, and it was just, again, just learning more about what it was really like to be a replacement, interviewing Babe Heffron a lot, spent a lot of time talking to him, talking to Ralph Spina, who was a replacement, and just the whole zeitgeist of it all was a lot of fun, and just figuring it out. And, you know, so that's, and then I also did some uncredited work on episode one. There's a couple of scenes in episode one that I had my sticky fingers in.
Now you're going to tell me it's a spaghetti scene.
No. I wish. So nothing that I've, you know, I mean, it's, I it was just a couple of lines, you know, it was not a lot of work, but yeah.
And,
you know,
and so you were on, the writers were on set the entire time when your episode was being done?
No, which was odd for television. I got to the set when they hired me to rewrite episode four. They flew me out to the set. Was it episode four? Yeah. And so I went out to the set and just to take a look at it so I could get an image of what I could write, given, you know, and it was cool. It was spectacular. And the day that I arrived there was the day that the actors got out of boot camp.
Oh, wow.
And they got there and they'd had their fittings and they came on with their, you know, they'd bloused their boots, you know, their dungarees, and they came in, big, more arrogant group of, you know, cock of the walk actors you have never seen in your life. They were so chuffed with themselves. And I remember calling Eric Jenderson and I said, dudes, I've just seen the cast. They're unbelievable. I mean, this is going to be, they're like so right. All of them were so good.
Wow.
And they did the table read for episode one. So it was a lot of fun to sit in on that and listen to that. But after that, I never went back to the set. I know some of the, I know a couple of the writers went to the set, but not for the shooting. They didn't bring us in for the shooting.
Well, no, because you mentioned before that sometimes the actors would say to you, well, can you add in something into the episode? I would assume, my assumption was, is that, you know, it was happening on, you know, on the fly.
Some of it did. Some of it happened before. They had, you know, once they got cast, they immediately called the guy that they were depicting if they were alive, or the family members,
mm-hmm.
if they weren't. And so they began to dig into this really, really deeply and talk to the wives, the widows, the sisters, the, you know, so they might have questions they would call while we were still writing the scripts. And then I'm sure during the filming, they ad-lib stuff and, you know, and normally the writer's on set, but I think because it was a big production with a lot of directors who were sort of more in the film world, I just think they didn't, you know, they just made the changes and went, you know, and that worked out, because my attitude as a writer, as an actor, if you've written a good enough script and you have a good enough actor and a good enough director, when they ad lib, it generally means they have a better way of saying what you were trying to say in your script.
Right.
And you're just digging the ditch that you started a little deeper. And it's, you know, for me, it's, I never, you know, it's only when that violates, you know, future stuff or the spirit of what you've tried to create that do I ever step in. Didn't have the chance on Band, but I didn't need to. I mean, we totally trusted the actors. They were brilliant.
Wow. That's really cool. So like when you first watched Band of Brothers, you know, I'm assuming you probably watched it, you know, when they did some sort of viewing, you know, for the men or something like that, wasn't it? Or you got to just watch it on HBO like everyone else?
Yeah, right. Well, it's funny because when I wrote Band, I didn't have a television because I got so pissed off at the cable company, Los Angeles, that I just disconnected it. So I didn't have a TV while I was writing Band. I did not actually watch any television. And I reconnected my cable for the premiere in 2001.
Wow.
But before that, they had a premiere in Normandy,
mm-hmm.
And everybody went. They flew us over there with our spouses, and they had a, I guess it was at Utah Beach, they had a huge tent, and they brought the veterans over, and they showed clips from episode one, and then the complete episode two. And that's the first, I'd seen a couple of pieces of footage here and there, really. Some of the other writers had seen the episodes. They'd gone into to see the cuts, which I didn't see.
Mm-hmm.
So the first time I ever saw any appreciable footage was sitting in an audience of 2,000 people, including the men themselves, and watching episode two. You know, and it was incredible.
I guess they chose
it was
episode two because it's the shortest of all the episodes.
And also because it had combat, and episode one, first episodes are always really difficult in these in limited series because you got to kill a bunch of birds with one stone.
Right.
They're never really satisfactory. There's no combat in it. It's, you know, it's learning who the characters are. It's just set up, really.
Right. It's
there's
showing
a lot
us
of conflict.
It's showing us
it's well
bond.
done.
Right. It's showing us the bond between these band of brothers, you know, and it does it so effectively.
Yeah. And then, but episode two is the, you know, it's got some holy shit sequences in it.
Oh, for
and
sure.
So they showed that, and then a lot of them, I mean, some of the men wept when they watched it. It was pretty profound. It was one of the most profound days of my life because, you know, we got down there on this special train that they chartered, and we got into the village, and there were hundreds of people waiting for us, and all the children were there. They'd made postcards. Thank you for saving us. Viva la USA.
Wow.
They come up to the men and touch them. And it was unbelievable. I mean, it was incredible. You know, it was so moving, you know. And then we had a dinner down there at some, you know, I forget where we had a dinner at a fancy restaurant. It was an incredible day. It really was.
Wow. Wow.
So.
Okay. And then when was the first time you saw your episodes, the ones that you wrote?
After I got my television. And I remember I had a little viewing party for episodes. Obviously, I'd seen episode four before that, but episode six, and we had my wife cooked up some northern, like Belgian French, I forget, it was some chicken dish with a sauce, you know, it was like a Bastogne meal, you know, and we had a couple friends
That
over
was the same
and we
episode
watched the episode.
that the men had, though.
Right. And, you know, and I had heard, it's interesting, you know, no one knew when Band came out that it was going to be any good. You have to remember this. You know, World War II was not popular. I was told when I got to Hollywood, when I wrote my Navajo Code Talker script, don't do World War II. It's dead. It's career suicide out here.
Well, wasn't it Saving Private Ryan that pretty much burned it?
Yeah,
Down?
that's what, yeah.
So,
yeah, Saving, but that's not television.
That's true. Okay.
So, you know, Saving Private Ryan did rejuvenate it all, and thank God. And I don't know if you know this, but the band was born out of the research for Saving Private Ryan because Ryan was in the 506th. So they read Band of Brothers
and
for his character.
Also, one of the Nyland brothers was best friends with Skip Muck, I believe. I think.
Something like that, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's what George
so,
Les told me. George Les
right,
Jr.
And so, that's right. And so, God bless George Luz Jr. He's a great guy.
Oh yeah, I've had two interviews.
He's
with
the
him.
Best.
He's amazing to speak to.
He's a wonderful human being. But yeah, so they that's you know they had the book and Kirk Sadusky at Playtone, who was an executive over there, went to Tom Hanks and said this would make an incredible limited series, and so they you know that's where it was born.
Right.
So the first review of Band of Brothers came out in the Wall Street Journal. And it was excoriating. It was like Tom and Steven play G.I. Joes in their sandbox, and it's trite and stupid. And I mean, it was a bad review,
Wow.
The first review of Band. And then, of course, 2 days after the premiere, 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And we thought, I mean, look, you're like, 9/11 happens. You're like, holy shit, I guess nobody's going to watch our little miniseries now. You know,
right.
We got bigger fish to fry. And in fact, it made the series indispensable in America because it became a cultural juggernaut for an audience to understand what it's like to go to war.
Right.
So, and to be comforted by it. So it's, you know, to be that it's something that it can be narratively constructed so you can deal with it.
Right.
It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Yes, people die, people suffer, but we win.
Right. Right. Timing is everything.
Yeah. And so, and then the reviews started coming in from other places, including the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, where the editor excoriated her own reporter and says, "You're full of shit. This is incredible." You know, so that was, but you know, so when I saw it finally in the sixth week, there had been a few positive reviews, but no one really knew. I didn't know if the episode was any good or not.
Well, actually, you probably saw it in the third week because they did two episodes every week, didn't they?
Oh, that's right. They did the first two and then episode, the fourth week. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, and I knew that episode six was frankly better than episode four.
Well, of course, you wrote
it. For my, Well, I wrote episode 4 too, essentially. So I had more to play with emotionally in episode 6. But yeah, it came out and it was like, holy shit, this is really good. So I hope other people like it.
But
so it was nerve-wracking.
Were you happy with the end result? Because as you said, what you necessarily put on paper isn't what we have gotten to watch over the last 25 years.
Yeah, that's a very good thing to bring up. Yeah, the director David Leland, who's since passed away, did an incredible job. And it's a beautiful episode, the way he shot it. He also rewrote some of it before it went into production. And I don't agree with some of the things he did, but I do agree with some of it, like I said earlier, he dug my ditch deeper and made it better. Mm-hmm. Some of it was a ditch that I didn't necessarily want him digging, but it didn't really matter. He took a lot of the dark humor out of the episode. There was a lot of funny shit that happened at Bastogne because they had no other way of dealing with how miserable they were. And so, and I felt that it made the episode more moving because, that's the aesthetic of the Pacific. It's like, we're going to go there. It's going to be a lot of darkness. This is how men deal with it, And I guess the director felt like he, in my opinion, didn't trust the material enough that would play with what was going on with Eugene and Renee and everything else. It's a very earnest episode in some ways. So he did that. And then he trimmed some of that. There was a couple other characters that he might've trimmed out or put dialogue in different, and the one scene that he did that I did not write, the two things that he did that I loved what he did is the scene where the paratrooper bleeds out with the two nurses and Eugene try and save his life. That's an incredible scene. And, it really hit the theme of the episode of the blood of Christ, of sacrifice, of futility, of, I mean, it's beautifully done and shot. And so when I saw it, I'm like, oh, okay, he got my script.
Wow.
And he did a great job. And then the second thing he did, which dug my ditch deeper, which I kicked myself for not doing, is it was his choice to have Eugene at the end take the blue kerchief, which I constructed, and make it into a bandage. I had Eugene just keep it as a keepsake, but it's much better to turn it into a bandage, right? That's like brilliant.
Yeah.
So David, I my hat's off to David. He did a may he rest in peace. He did a really wonderful job. Wonderful job.
That is so amazing. Okay, so you finish Band of Brothers, and then a few years later, they say, we want you on the Pacific.
Yeah. How did that happen? Well, it's a funny story, and it's the Pacific started the night of the Emmys for Band, because the writers lost.
Yeah.
We lost. We were nominated. We thought, there's no way we're going to lose. And we lost. So I was like, oh, man, what a bummer. We went to this huge HBO party. This is in the heyday of HBO's massive, they had more money than God. So there was a party inside the HBO party just for Band of Brothers. So we go to the inner sanctum party inside the swanky HBO party, which is itself the swankiest party in Hollywood for the Emmys. And Wolfgang Puck is cooking just for the cast and crew of Band of Brothers in his restaurant. And we're all there. The men are there, the families. And there was a table reserved for Steven Spielberg and his wife. And it literally said, Mr. and Mrs. Spielberg, nobody else could sit there. So I went over to Steven. I said, thank you for giving me the opportunity. He had briefly been attached to direct episode 6 before David Leland, but he had developed some health issues and he couldn't shoot it. So I went over and just said, thank you for the opportunity. And his wife, Kate Capshaw, said, you guys were robbed, the writers. And I said, thank you. We feel the same way. And I turned to Steven and I said, look, if you ever want to do a similar show in the Pacific, I'd love to write a couple episodes for the show. That's all I said. And he's like, I'll keep that in mind. Right. So then flash forward 18 months, the phone rings. It's Gary Getzman, Tom Hanks's producing partner. Hey, Tom and Steven and I want to sit down with you to talk to you about doing a show about the Pacific. So I'm like, oh, so I go, okay. Went into Steven's office. Which is the most intimidating office in all of Hollywood. You go in the office and Rosebud, the sled from Citizen Kane, is on the wall, and Norman Rockwell paintings and Oscars and, you know, pictures of him with, you know, it's just, it's fun. I mean, it's a great place to be. And Steven's a very gracious host. And so we go in there, we sit down, and we just brainstormed and we talked about everything and whether it should be fictional, whether it should be real, how difficult, it's much bigger. Who do we focus on? Do we do the Navy? How do we do this? And Steven said, look, I've been looking into the Pacific for about 6 months now, and I hired Hugh Ambrose, who was Steven Ambrose's son and researcher, to begin interviewing people in the Pacific to look for stories. And Hugh had begun interviewing guys from the first, not just the first, but from the Marine Corps. And so they had sort of, and so Hugh sent me a database of his interviews and sort of a paragraph or two on each interview of so and so. He was the corporal in the 5th Marines. He was on Guadalcanal. This guy was at New Britain. And so I looked through that. I called Hugh. And so Hugh Ambrose was actually the first guy hired on the Pacific.
Stephen Ambrose had
Not
already
me.
passed away at this point, right?
No, I
He died in
when did he die?
2002.
It was
He died in
close to the
2002.
end. Yes, he had died. He had just died when they called me. That's correct. I forget the actual date. It was probably in the fall of 2002. So, yeah, that makes sense. Maybe the fall,
Right.
somewhere
He
in there.
died
I'm not
in
100% sure.
October 3rd, on October 13th.
Yeah, it was right
Okay,
around the
right.
time that he died. He might have died within a week or of this meeting. I don't remember. Anyway, so I called Hugh and we sat down and began brainstorming. I began reading books and looking into it. And so I figured out very quickly that I had to be the Marine Corps. It had to be the 1st Marine Division, because if you're going to go from the beginning of the war to the end of the war, the 1st Marine Division or men in the 1st Division, 1st Marine Division fight at Guadalcanal, and some of them fight all the way into Okinawa. They might have been transferred, they might have been in the 5th or the 6th, but they might have started in the 1st. And then, you know, so from there, it's, you know, I started thinking about it. Who do I pick? So, you know, just started looking at these interviews, reading these books, and then very quickly said, you know what? I love this book, With the Old Breed by Eugene Sledge. He's in the 5th Marine. He's in the K-3-5, but, you know, he's in New Britain. He's at Peleliu. How do I fit him in? I don't know yet. I'll put a pin in that guy. And then I read Leckie's book, Helmet for My Pillow, which is the sort of the 1950s version of Sledge's book. It's not quite as honest, not quite as raw, it's not quite as good, in my opinion. It's a little bit more has more
Even though
artifice in it.
Leckie was the
He's an
writer.
Irish. Yeah, he's an Irishman and he's a writer. So there's a little bit of flourish to it all. And so I read him. I said, well, he's on Guadalcanal. And then he goes and he's on Peleliu. You know, wow, well, Sledge is on Peleliu. Maybe and then I called up and interviewed Sledge's friend Sid Phillips, who was on Guadalcanal. And Sid then told me in the bombshell of all bombshells, oh, Leckie, I was in Leckie's company. I know that
Wow.
eight ball. That's the way he described me. And then when he said that, I mean, literally goosebumps over my entire body. I
I'm
knew I
getting
had a
goosebumps just
show.
listening to the
Because I
story.
could connect these guys. Yeah, I knew I could connect, you know, from A to Z through Sid, through Peleliu. I could put them in the same place at the same time. It is possible, although not probable, that they spoke to each other because of Sid Phillips. We don't know, but I took that liberty and felt comfortable taking that liberty. And they were certainly within a few hundred yards of each other on Peleliu. So knowing which beach they came in on and you know, so it was that was one of the great moments of my writing career was because I did the research and dug in so deeply and interviewed these guys that were still alive, I got my series out of it. You know, so you know, and we just researched it and then I originally the Pacific had two additional characters who were aviators. One was a both naval aviators. One flew at the Battle of Midway and then it was in the Cactus Air Force on Guadalcanal briefly. And then the other was Floyd Hall from the book Flyboys, who flew Chichijima and was shot down and eaten by the Japanese. You know, and we were going to put them in the show as well. But it was too big and too sprawling. And so we cut the aviators out of the show. But anyway, so that's how it all came together. I went in to pitch Spielberg and Hanks about 6 months after they had that meeting. I said, before I tell you the story, these are the characters I want to base it on and why. And I told them who the characters were. And they said, go write that and come back. And I said, well, I'm not going to write you a Bible first. I'm just going to write you an outline to a Bible because it's so big. And I turned that outline in May of 2003, I think. And they greenlit me to the scripts at HBO off that outline because I just had like a page or two for each episode, who the characters were. Stephen and Tom loved it. And they said, go write the scripts. So I began choosing writers to work with. And we then started writing the series in 2003. Took us
Yeah,
5 years to
seriously.
do the
But
production.
how did Bassilon get connected into there?
That's a good, yeah. Well, Bassilon was great because he's on Guadalcanal and he's also on Iwo Jima. So I could get all the most famous battles with Bassilon. And he was in the 1st Marine Division. He would have, he was with Chesty Puller. Chesty's on Peleliu. I could connect him in any way I wanted to dramatically on Guadalcanal. Because you have to remember, Guadalcanal is a pretty small place to be in August and September of 1942. And so, and I also wanted a character. Look, it's right there in the title of the show, The Pacific. It's a show that is ironic on the face of it. Band of Brothers is not ironic. It is a heartfelt paean to
Correct.
heroism. It is a celebration. The Pacific is the most expensive anti-war film ever made. It is not flag waving in the way that Band is. It is much more, well, it's much more accurate about the moral corrosiveness of combat. And so it's in the title. The title's ironic. And so Lucky is an ironic character. Sledge, in some ways, his arc is one of irony, where the hometown boy becomes a
Well,
killer
he's
and
also,
then,
his father
comes
doesn't
out
want
of
him to
it.
go because his father doesn't want him to change, but he, as a youth, fights
Right.
against his father and eventually realizes at the end
Yeah.
that, hey, what do you know? My father
Yeah.
was right.
Yes. So there's a lot of irony in the story and everywhere in that in the Pacific. It's a very, in that sense, late 20th, early 21st century, Hollywood production, in the way that Sopranos is ironic and Breaking Bad is ironic, and it's a little darker, and it's a lot darker, but I wanted a character who wasn't that, who was just the Greek hero doing and dying. And John Bassilone was that man. I mean, I did a lot of research into him. I found his best friend from the Marine Corps who served with him on Guadalcanal, who was still alive. And an interview, I have, his my interviews with him are profound. John Bassilone is nothing like the way that he was depicted in popular literature, or he was not a boxer. He was very sensitive, funny, quirky. We tried to capture that, and he was the do or die guy. I remember writing the sequence on Guadalcanal where he picks up the
And he
machine gun
burns
and
his
he and,
hands.
he, and this is all true. It really happened. And burns his hands. It really happened. Burned his arms, and Tom Hanks said, "We can't put that in the show. It's just a Hollywood trope. It's like Rambo." I'm like, "Tom, it happened." He goes, "I don't believe it happened. You have to prove to me it happened." So I found all these different, both sources, interviews, and he said, "Okay, really? That's who he was. He was that guy." And he was far braver on Iwo Jima, which is, on the beach there. It was. What he did was incredible, getting those guys off the beach. And so I wanted somebody that was the classical Greek hero who died literally for his country. So, and all the stuff about him playing golf, that's all true.
I mean, one of the things I like about
So
Bassilon is that we get to see both sides of him. We get to see the side of him fighting, and we also get to see the side of him of loving.
yeah. And he did, she died before I could interview her, Lena, but there's somebody in her family that I was able to get in touch with. I can't remember, a niece maybe, but I do know that she kept his dog tags in her purse the rest of her life, and she never remarried, and she was a tough broad too. She was a really so I really enjoyed crafting and then giving the writers who fleshed it out their story because it's so moving to me. And you know, and the cost of what he did for all of us,
right?
To her, you know, he obviously dies, but you know, she's the one with an empty hole in her heart for the rest of her life. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, that's just amazing. But is there a reason why it took so long to get the to get the show finally released? I mean, you said if you started working on it in the end of 2002, beginning 2003. So we're talking 7 years.
Almost. Yeah, we started filming in 2007, and it came out in
right,
2010.
March 14th, 2010 was the first episode came out.
Right. My birthday.
There you go.
So that's right. Yeah. No, the reason why it took so long is, you know, it took maybe a year to write the first 13 episodes with the five writers that we hired. And then I turned them all in, and we had this big meeting with Hanks and Spielberg. And Spielberg said to me, I love your second episode, The Battle of Midway. I just love it. I've always wanted to do Midway, but it's going to cost us $50 million alone for that episode. It was the most holy shit episode you've ever seen. You know, diving on those four carriers, and it was incredible. Aircraft carriers, and you know, dudes in the water, and it was all based on this real guy named Bob Elder, who had been a Dauntless pilot, and you know, and then went on to be a who trained other flyers later in the war. And his girlfriend, who became his wife, woke up on December 7th, went out on her porch, her lanai, and watched a Japanese torpedo plane fly right over her roof. I mean, you know, so she watched Pearl Harbor in front of her. So we had a character. So, but so then, you know, so then we had to throw out the aviators. Okay, well, let's make it 10 episodes. We have to go back to the drawing board, reinvent the structure. How do we do it? We didn't lose the three Marines that we picked, but we had to weave them together a little tighter. And, you know, we had to do that. We did that. And then we had the political fight inside HBO of whether to make this. And this is the part of Hollywood that viewers never, you know, really see, that how the sausage is made. We knew it was going to be, we had preliminary budgets of 320 million bucks if we did it in Hawaii, 240 if we did it in Australia, twice the budget of Band.
Wow.
Twice. Now, Band had been very successful, but there were a lot of internal dissent from what we learned inside HBO. People might have wanted that money to make other shows. Because if you make the Pacific, that means somebody
right.
else's show doesn't get made. And so it was probably a year of back and forth. They weren't sure. You know, we don't know. Is it Band of Brothers Part Two? How do we market it? Blah, blah. And finally, Chris Albrecht pulled the trigger and said, we're doing this. And I got the call in a parking lot in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We greenlit the show, and you know, we were off to the races. So, and it took a year, almost a year of prep too. I mean, we had to, you know, I was in Australia 6 months before we started shooting. They flew me to Guadalcanal. I flew to Peleliu. I spent time in both battlefields, you know, just soaking it up, and then going back to the scripts and tweaking them, and you know. So it was an incredible process.
Sounds
a
like
lot
it.
Of fun.
Sounds like it. Sounds like you definitely have stories that keep you going.
Keep me warm on a cold night and a Bastogne night. Yeah.
Oh, wow. that's just amazing. Amazing. I enjoy watching both of those. So you at least have
yeah,
one.
Yeah, they're
fan,
very different you know. Shows. Oh, that's nice. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm very proud to have worked on both. They're defining for my career. You know, and I'm very proud of the work that all of us did on them. But I always tell people, you know, if we'd done Band of Brothers after the Pacific, it wouldn't have been the same.
Well, you wouldn't have, you definitely wouldn't have had
you know,
the men around either. That, you see, that's one of the things with Band of Brothers that I see as opposed to the Pacific, because of the 10-year gap or almost 10-year gap between them, that Band of Brothers, you had the opportunity to speak to more of the men.
Yeah.
With the Pacific.
There's no question that it helped enrich the show. I mean, the Pacific, Sid Phillips was alive. I talked to people who had direct contact mm-hmm. with all of those men. And some of them, you know, like Chuck Tatum, who's a character on Iwo Jima. I spent a lot of time with Chuck. And Chuck loved Bassilone and had kept all of his Bassilone
Oh, wow.
memorabilia since the war, you know. And so it was, you know, and talking to Bassilone's best friend, a guy named Richard Greer, who'd gone on to be a very successful businessman. And, you know, he sent me photo. I have photographs of Bassilone that no one has ever seen that he had on his, you know, his own private photographs. Bassilone coming out of the showers on Melbourne, you know, he never, his quirk was he would never towel off. He would never dry himself with a towel. So I got him coming out of the shower, you know, with his boxers on and, you know, smiling at the camera, just goofy pictures of him. So funny, you know? And so, yeah, but you're right. I mean, having the guys themselves, but it also, it made it more accurate, but it also made it less accurate because there's stories we could not tell. Now, if Sledge had been alive, could I have told the story? Well, yes, because he put it in his book because he was ruthlessly honest with his own moral corrosion, I guess you would call it. But there are stories that I don't think we could have told if the guys had been alive in the Pacific and vice versa for Band. You know, so it
Okay.
cuts both
That's
ways.
fair.
And because Band was more a celebration, you know, we didn't show who shot Spears in the ass in Holland. It was somebody in Easy Company. You know, we don't show them summarily executing SS officers and all, you know, in the Alps,
Right.
which they did. You know, I was told directly after we did the show. Now I was told by a guy, now that the show is out, I can tell
Wow.
you what really happened. You know, and there's a lot of darkness there. You know, there's like one example is we focus a lot on Garnier and Buck and Lipton. You know, Lipton was as that sort of a node of men around those guys. And I forget, I think they're in the third platoon and not so much on first and
Right.
second platoons. And we mixed the platoons up all the time with guys. We didn't care. But they definitely with, you know, with that. And why is that? Well, it's not just because Garnier gets his leg blown off and we can follow him and he's a really colorful character. It's not just that we can then get Babe Heffron, his best friend in the show. It's not just, you know, it's the reason why is Dick Winters said to me, and we didn't put it in the show, is because the sergeants in charge of like first platoon did not meet their objective on D-Day. They hunkered down and they didn't try to
Wow.
make the objective. And I never trusted them ever again in the war with anything of import. So Winters ground the shit out of third platoon because they got the job done and they have
Right.
the highest casualty rate in the war. And the other two platoons didn't, and because Winters didn't trust them as much.
Right.
Well, that, you know,
No.
that doesn't
No,
fit
it
the
does
theme
not.
of Band of Brothers. And so it's a marvelous little historical tidbit, you know. But so there's things like that that we blanked in Band because we didn't want to hurt people's feelings. And
Right. Okay, so now the most important question of this conversation between us is, so what are you, Tom, and Steven now working on?
I, you know, it's funny. I did not work on Masters of the Air. John Orloff did. That was his duty overseas. And I don't know if those guys are going to do it. I don't think, you know, I don't know if they'll do another war series. So I haven't worked for those guys. I wrote a script for them a few years ago that was, it was World War II based, but it was not combat. It was about Alfred Loomis, who was the financier who developed radar at the Rad Lab in Boston at MIT. And who, you know, is the guy probably more than any other individual who saved the world, you know, with money and intellect. But I haven't worked for them. I mean, I wrote a script for Steven, an animated film for him that didn't get made a few years ago. So I've, you know, stay in touch with them, but I haven't done any, I haven't worked with them in a while. So, but I do, I mean, I haven't left World War II completely. I have a show. I'm hopeful I'll have a show on MGM about a World War II submarine that I wrote for them, an ongoing series that they're,
Oh,
I'm
wow.
waiting to hear if
Well,
it gets
good
picked
luck
up.
with that.
So yeah, that'll be a lot of
Sounds
fun.
like it.
So.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm
excellent. Well, thanks for having me. Good luck with it.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I will be back tomorrow with another episode. But until then, Kerry.